There's a critical debate taking place over one of our most treasured rights, free speech. We argue about whether it's at risk, whether college students fear it, whether neo-Nazis deserve it, and whether the government is adequately upholding it. P.E. Moskowitz is the author of the new book, The Case Against Free Speech, The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. In the book, they look at shining a light on the powerful conservative forces that have waged a multi-decade battle to hijack the meaning of free speech. P.E. Moskowitz is a journalist, formerly with Al Jazeera America, and has written for such publications as The Guardian and The New York Times. The new book is The Case Against Free Speech, The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. And we welcome P.E. Moskowitz to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to this subject of wanting to look in depth into where we are when it comes to free speech?
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of always as a journalist and author, I'm looking to go beyond the kind of headlines we see on a daily basis. So my first book was about gentrification, and it kind of came out of the same desire. You know, there were so many stories about, you know, mustachioed hipsters and whatever. And so I just needed to know what was actually going on gentrification-wise. And then the same was true with free speech. I'd see, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of op-eds and news stories about how college students were bringing fascism to America by protesting conservative speakers and things like that. And I thought there must be something deeper going on. So I wanted to just kind of explore the history and actually report out all of these flashpoints of our supposed free speech crisis.
So let us begin with one of those flashpoints. The third chapter in the book is entitled Campus Wars, Middlebury. Since this campus is in our listening area, let us talk about it and what happened on the campus of Middlebury College in 2015.
So in 2015, the American, I think it was the AEI club of the university, one of their conservative groups, invited Charles Murray, the kind of controversial semi-scientist. He's not really a scientist, but he writes a lot about science. The main thing he's known for is the bell curve, which kind of posits that IQ is predictable based on race and poverty. And it's been widely debunked amongst the scientific community. But he was invited. The president of the college was going to introduce him. So the college, you know, even though the college wasn't officially the one that invited him, they were kind of sanctioning this event and you know, promoting it. And that caused a lot of controversy on the Middlebury campus. And I think it's important to note both at Middlebury and kind of everywhere where these kinds of things have happened is to recognize the context they're happening in. It's just not random. This is happening at a time where students and everyone in America is talking about Black Lives Matter, about police shootings, about, you know, racism. You know, it's as Donald Trump is rising in the polls into the, people into 2016, and people are getting scared about encroaching fascism in this country. So to students at Middlebury, it wasn't just some abstract discussion. It was more a material threat to their safety and to their intellectual environment on campus. So they ended up protesting Murray and kind of trying to shut down the talk.
You make two points in the chapter. One is that colleges are easy targets because the students are, by their very nature, temporary, part of a temporary community. So they're, they don't have a lot of room for pushback.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think we have to remember that colleges are never bastions of free speech. I mean, they have admissions policies, which, you know, we don't consider free speech violations. They have grading, they hire certain professors, but not others. You can be disciplined. You can be kicked out of a college. These are not bastions for free speech. And it's only when conservative speakers are disinvited or not invited somewhere that we kind of claim free speech. But again, these are some of the most restrictive speech environments out there.
You're right. I found what happened at Middlebury and at dozens of other schools with similar stories was really about much more than free speech, but about everything that free speech can mask, namely our unsettled history of racism. How so?
As I was saying, you have to remember the context that this happened during the kind of rise of Black Lives Matter around right. nationwide protests, but also because of the particular talk that Murray was giving and his work. I mean, his work has been funded by ultra-conservative groups. He cites pretty openly white nationalist supposedly scientific data in his book. And students pointed out to me, you know, they wouldn't invite, let's say, a global warming denier to campus because Bill McKibben teaches at Middlebury, and that would go against their academic standards. So to them, it's not about free speech because obviously they're restricting some things that don't live up to their academic standards. It's about saying racism does live up to their academic standards, and students wanted to kind of point out that hypocrisy.
So how did we get to this point where we think of free speech as you label it as not a myth, and having never really had a full reality in this country?
I think free speech was always somewhat of a myth. I mean, you have to remember that when the First Amendment was passed, the founding fathers and everyone, you know, within the United States government, you know, sanctioned slavery. They, if you were going to vote, and that, you know, in my opinion, is one of the most important ways one could express their free speech, you had to be a white property owning man, so that limited voting to 6% of the population. So free speech was never as free as we thought it was right from the very beginning. I think how we got to this current supposed crisis we're in, where everyone thinks free speech is going down the tube or whatever, is because of a very concerted campaign from ultra-conservatives starting in the 1970s to kind of push this narrative that if you disparage a conservative speaker, if you care about things like social justice or anti-racism, and if you, you know, kind of make a ruckus as a protester, that you're somehow infringing on someone's right to free speech, specifically conservatives' right to free speech. And that's a very purposeful kind of campaign that started in the 70s with the Koch brothers, the John M. Olin Foundation, the family of Betsy DeVos, who all kind of pushed to fund these academics who would write things like Dinesh D'Souza's A Liberal Education, which came out in the early 90s, and Alan Blom's The Closing of the American Mind. All these, you know, supposedly scholarly works that actually were just kind of pushing this very conservative view into college campuses, into the American mainstream, and also at the same time claiming that if you disagreed with those conservative views, that you were silencing free speech.
So you believe that the ideal of free speech can be achieved. It'll just look differently than what we think it's going to look like.
Right. To me, free speech doesn't mean anything if no one's there to hear you speak it. And I think one of the things we don't talk about when we talk about free speech is how it is, how the kind of intricacies of it get mirrored through our income inequality, our racism, and everything else in this country. I mean, when we think of the Second Amendment, for example, we know that politics go into that, that people are influencing it at all times, that, you know, there's a history of race and guns and domestic violence and guns and all the rest. But when we think of the First Amendment, we think of it as somehow pure and untainted by politics, which I think is just flat out wrong. In my opinion, in order to increase free speech for everyone, what we need to be doing is thinking about what limits people's ability to speak and to be heard. And that would be the same things that limit everyone's freedom in this country, oppression of all kinds. So, you know, on paper, because of the First Amendment, sure, we're all allowed to speak in the same way. But I, as an author, have much more of a right to be heard than your average person. And the Koch brothers have much more of an ability to be heard because they can spend billions of dollars funding entire political movements. So to me, increasing speech for everyone is about decreasing inequality.
And when it comes to free speech, you write in the book that government certainly has not been our friend.
It's complicated, but for the most part, the times that the government has upheld the right to speak has been in favor of of Nazis and white supremacists, and the times that they've limited free speech has usually been against leftists and people of color. So, I mean, even the most famous quote we have about free speech, you can say anything, but you can't shout fire in a crowded theater, has nothing to do with fires or theaters. It has to do with in the 1910s and 1920s, there was a lot of leftist dissent against World War I. And at the time, the Supreme Court ruled that if you were handing out pamphlets or agitating against U.S. imperialism or U.S. intervention in World War I, you were doing the equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater and therefore could be jailed for your dissent. So throughout history, we like to think that we've really valued free speech, but you can look at dozens and dozens of examples of how that's not true.
The name of the book is The Case Against Free Speech, The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. P.E. Moskowitz, thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. Again, the name of the book is The Case Against Free Speech, published by Bold Type Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.